You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up into
Tuscaloosa. A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
So we can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches of cold tonight. Then that snow.
The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Madison.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening, and thank you for joining the Weather Junkies. We are joining you live this Thursday evening, April 28th, the final Thursday already of the month of April. When we join you next week, it'll be May 5th, and hopefully by then the weather is resembling spring and not kind of this in-between junk that we're stuck in here in Connecticut. Anyways, I'm Tyler Jankowski, joining the show as always from Connecticut alongside Dakota Smith, who is in Colorado.
Good evening, everyone, and good evening, Tyler. Yeah, you know, we're not having the greatest spring right now either. It's been a pretty dreary 2 days here, overcast skies right now. A little bit of snow today, a little bit of rain, and overnight we're supposed to get some more precip, and some models are spitting out like 10 inches up here, but I think soil temps are going to be too warm, and we're not going to get much accumulation. It'll be snowing, but not much accumulation over the next few days. So you said the weather out there is not the greatest spring weather either. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm being picky or what. I mean, I can't remember a spring that has been perfect, but I don't think that's the point of spring. I guess 2012 was quite nice with the warmth, but you know, we started the month of April with 2 weekends of snow, back-to-back weekends, fifth snowiest April on record. And that did a number on the daffodils and a lot of the normally beautiful spring flowers that come out early on. Didn't completely kill the daffodils. I know in State College in Central PA, the daffodils were just flat out brown. So it wiped out the daffodils to the west, where there was probably a little bit more snow. So, you know, we had snow to start, a little bit of a slow start to spring. We did have that 1 week period with blue sky, not a cloud for days and days. But I mean, it's surrounded by yuck. I mean, right now we're in a pattern where the next 7 days, we don't have one day that's going to be above average or even at average. Some days are 10, 20 degrees below average. I think we might be stuck in the 40s on Sunday with rain. So, you know, even though it was nice for that 1 week stretch, that's about it for nice weather this spring.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it warms up a bit. We got a message from JP. He's always viewing the show. Thank you, JP. It says it's not going to be spring here in California. 90s possible this weekend after less than a tenth of rain yesterday. At least they got some rain, I guess. It's not a lot, but 90s this weekend in California. That's Southern
Sounds
California.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, again, not Southern California. But
the highest we've hit is 81 back in March.
Oh, wow. And haven't seen anything like that since?
No, we haven't hit 80 since, I don't believe. I know that was the earliest we've ever seen 80.
Onto the tweets of the week, and they have a theme this week, and the theme is the severe weather outbreak. Yes, I'm calling it an outbreak. I don't care what people say, because I'm pretty fired up about it, and Tyler, I'm sure you have some comments too. So I thought we would start off with the visible satellite imagery, and this comes from Dan Lindsay. He's always bringing us beautiful satellite imagery. And it's 1 minute imagery, and his tweet says, possibly my favorite satellite loop of the year. A course in satellite meteorology could be taught with this movie alone. Dan is a meteorologist with the NOAA in Fort Collins. And wow, some of the tops there of the storms, and they just explode as that dry line moved through Texas and Oklahoma. And I was actually chasing this event, and it was a lot of fun. I was actually chasing with our guest last week, Jacob DeFlitch, and a fellow Penn Stater, Brad Gay. And it was a lot of fun. You know, we didn't see the tornadic activity that some of us were hoping to see, but it's certainly a good thing for that area that they didn't have, you know, the long track strong tornadoes. Were you following this at all, Tyler?
A little bit. I had my eye on it just in case it exploded into a huge outbreak.
Yeah.
You know, you usually have a sense for when something might happen, and then it turns into like a long track tornado. I guess it's a good thing that didn't happen.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. But I definitely had an eye on Twitter every hour or two, trying to make sure that I was a little bit attached to what was going on. But
right.
I mean, it seems like it was less than. I know this is a dangerous path to go down. But it was less than what a lot of people thought it would be.
Yeah, so
I don't really have a problem with that. I mean, it doesn't always have to be a devastating tornado outbreak.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And this goes perfectly into our next tweet. It's from Angela Fritz. She writes for the Washington Post, the Capital Weather Gang and the Washington Post. And the tweet is, you can follow her at Angela Fritz. The tweet says, "The details don't matter. If people expected a huge tornado outbreak on Tuesday, then we did a horrible job communicating." And it's a great piece, first of all. And she highlights that the SPC forecast was actually really good. And I think that is the general consensus. SPC did a great job, except for the PDS. The PDS was a little iffy for... They put out a particularly dangerous situation in a tornado watch for Oklahoma. And that was, I don't know, maybe shouldn't have done that. But overall, SPC did a great job highlighting hail and wind. And the tornado threat was not as prominent. And they said that it was a hail and wind event. And so I think they did a great job. But her point was that people were actually expecting a big tornado event. There was a lot of hype in the chaser community. There was a lot of hype from local people, which we'll get to in the next few tweets. And I think she's right. There's some issues with the, you know, if the forecast is great, that's fine. But if we're communicating a different message than the forecast actually is, then there's a disconnect there, and that's an issue. Even the Capital Weather Gang themselves, I believe one of their headlines was tornado. A big tornado event expected, something like that. And so, you know, they were probably part of the issue here. And so it's somewhere we have some work to do as a community. And I'm curious to how people perceived it locally. You know, Oklahoma shut down school for that evening, I believe. And I'm curious if people, you know, were expecting these big violent tornadoes, or if they were expecting the forecast that the SPC put out. I don't know, Tyler. I could go on and on about this. You know,
what I would add to the conversation is that as a forecaster in New England, my focus was on Connecticut, so I wasn't pulling up soundings and all kinds of good information for the midsection of the country. So most of what I knew about the outbreak was passively consumed on social media,
right?
Just glancing at what people were tweeting, the general buzz. I wasn't actually analyzing the model data or the conditions out in Oklahoma and Texas. And I thought when I left work, I thought that following evening would be very active with a lot of tornadoes. That was the impression I had from, again, the very, yeah, very little bit of information that I saw floating across social media. But apparently the Storm Prediction Center's actual tornado risk was quite low, like 10%, I think.
Right. Yeah, it was. It was 10%. Yeah.
One of the tweets I saw said the problem is they only break things down into categories in day one, not day right. two, day three, day four. And the general severe risk goes out, what, 8 days now? And apparently a week out, I did see a week out, the Storm Prediction Center was highlighting a certain area for severe weather. So the buzz did start about a week out.
Yeah.
But then you have to wait till day one to get the breakdown between tornado, hail, wind.
You know, if you were following the buzz, like you were just saying, then yeah, it was a bust. But that's because the buzz, I think, built it up to something that it was never going to be. And I saw a tweet from, I can't remember. It was a really great tweet. It said, it was when the day one percentages came out. And it said, if you know and have been looking at the models and you know what to look for and you're a well-seasoned chaser, you knew exactly what the SPC was going to put out. And I guess his point was that he wasn't expecting a big area of, I don't know, 15, 20% tornado risk. He was expecting exactly what they put out, and that was hail and wind emphasis.
So our next tweet is from Cody Kirkpatrick. His Twitter bio says he's an atmospheric scientist and educator, though it doesn't give a location. And the tweet is, last year's SPC moderate risk days ordered by resulting number of tornadoes. We'll link to the tweet in our YouTube video, as always. Basically, he tweets an image of a chart. It has about a dozen moderate risk days from last year, and then the number of tornadoes, wind reports, and hail reports that ensued. And then apparently with the tornado outbreak in question a couple days ago, there were 7 tornadoes, 224 wind reports, and 196 hail reports. And that would be, in terms of tornadoes, on the lower end when you compare.
Well, tornado number's been adjusted. It's now 13, I think, on the.
Now 13. Okay. Yeah. So it's right. It's almost right in the middle of the number of tornadoes. Just for those only listening, the last year, the least amount of tornadoes in a moderate risk, 4, the most was 50, and you said 13?
Yeah.
In the outbreak a couple days ago. There were a lot of wind reports. The rough draft number here is 224, and that is more, be second most when you compare it to last year's. Only one event last year surpassed that number with 537. So there were a lot of wind reports, yeah. Wind damage.
Yeah. So this tells me that this week's moderate risk kind of lined up with what it normally is. It's also kind of telling because, well, there's a misleading part of this. We don't know the area that was moderate risk. That's, you know, that can be a little misleading. If it was a large area of moderate risk compared to a smaller area, then these numbers will be off. But that's quite the range from last year. 4 to 50 tornado reports during a moderate risk.
Yeah, and if you look at the hail, and again, this is a rough number here, 196 that he tweeted on the 27th of April. That 196 hail reports, that would tie the most of all the moderate risk last year. So this definitely came through in the top, the upper echelon for wind and hail, when you compare it to last year's moderate risks.
Right. I'm trying to see if I'm assuming the hail and wind were also adjusted, but I'm not 100% sure. Let me look really quickly. No, actually, hail and wind were not adjusted. It was just the tornado. I guess they had to take some survey, some damage.
Yeah, there's always some fuzzy math involved.
Yeah, a lot of those tornadoes were embedded in kind of a conjoined cell system. So it was hard to see them at the time. And it was just, you know, after the fact they saw some.
Sometimes there's duplicated reports.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But, go ahead.
The wind and the hail perspective, this event was, at the top when compared to last year's moderate risks.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very, very impressive overall. And I think it goes to show that it wasn't a forecast bust. That's, to me, that's kind of the message I got.
Especially based on location. If you look at the classic, you know, post-event SPC outlook with dots overlaid on it, the location was superb.
Yeah. But there was a part of it where the perception was built up, either by local or by national media. And that brings us right into our next two tweets, actually. It's a twofer here. The first one is from Mike Morgan. You can follow him at Mike Morgan K4. He's a chief meteorologist at 4 News in Oklahoma City. And his tweet says, severe tornado outlook next 10 days in the viewing area. And in the graphic that he shows, that's really the important part of this tweet. The severe threat is 10 out of 10. And the tornado threat is 10 out of 10 as well. And then let's go, and this meteorologist also put out a tweet that said F4 possibility. He puts this.
This happens all the time.
It does happen all the time, and it's not the greatest thing. And then another local meteorologist, Damon Lane, you can follow him at KOCO, Damon Lane. He's the chief meteorologist at that station in Oklahoma City. And the tornado index he put out was 6 out of 10 on Tuesday. And moderate chance of tornado in zone. And the big difference here, I think, between both of these tweets, and they're both for the similar area, Mike Morgan doesn't include anything from the SPC, but Damon does include the moderate chance, which was issued by SPC. And, you know, 6 and 10 are pretty different numbers when it comes to tornado chance. And so my question to you, Tyler, and I'm asking you this because, you know, you're a broadcast met. What do you think about the having different indices for whether it's severe weather or snow? How do you feel about this and maybe stations differing in these indices? Does it help or does it hurt us or, you know, somewhere in the middle?
Well, I'm trying to think of what we do. I don't think it helps with all the conflicting messages, especially with everything being online now. It's easier for you to see the whole slate of forecasts than it was before. Easy to put together comparison graphics and say, look how confusing this is. When we have severe weather, we have an impact graphic that has, for severe weather, it has tornadoes, hail, wind, and maybe power outages. And our numbers go from 0 to 10. So, you know, my initial reaction would be, ooh, I don't really like this. But when I think of what we do, we actually do have a ranking from 0 to 10. And, you know, not that we really use it much, maybe it matters once a year when we actually have a tornado threat, 0 to 10. So we do have a ranking, but the SP, I mean, what would be the standard? The standard is the SPC outlook?
Yeah, I think so.
Because there's no number. I mean,
right.
No one puts out.
They have a percentage, right? And the point that Damon made is that he can't use those percentages because it's not like a 1 through 10 scale. The percentage.
Well, I don't think it's easy to understand. I would agree with him.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I'm trying to remember
Well, I'll be honest. I could not tell you what the SPC, the official definition is without me looking it up for like slight risk or moderate risk or high risk.
I think the percentages. I believe it's like that type of hail or tornado, severe hail, severe wind happening in a 25-mile radius. That's what the percentage means, but that doesn't mean anything to a viewer, right? That
the word would be abstract.
Yeah.
It's hard to understand. I mean, I always like the good old days when there was only a slight risk. None of this enhanced stuff. When we would have a slight risk in the Northeast, that was a big deal in New England, Connecticut, Massachusetts. I mean, you'd get big time severe weather.
I think it still is a big deal though.
Yeah, it still is a big deal. I don't think it does convey what's going to happen to the public. Slight to me sounds like no big deal.
Yeah.
Well, not to me, but you get the idea.
Yeah, right.
And then again, the percentages are very hard to understand. So back to your original question, I think that there needs to be a simpler way. And I think that that's what these meteorologists are trying to do. And, you know, competition comes into play. I mean, this is the TV business. Everyone has to have their own name for everything and their own way of doing things. And that's what you're seeing here in Oklahoma City. The the Mike Morgan tweet, I don't know much about the area down there, but the one thing that I'm able to gather from what goes on is he seems like a very popular chief meteorologist with the viewers, but maybe not necessarily with other scientists on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting conversation. I would be hesitant to totally knock him down because I don't know him. You know, maybe he is very skilled at what he does and just has some things that don't quite.
Yeah. No, I don't want to knock him down with everyone else.
I don't know.
When you have two different, everyone's going to have a different forecast, but when it's this different and you're using two different indices and then you have what SPC's saying, I feel like there's a lot of confusion there within the public. And one final thing, I wanted to come back to the SPC categories. I don't mind the categories. I think they're pretty good. In fact, some meteorologists use them even in their broadcast, which goes to show you that, you know, they think it's viewable for the public and that.
Yeah, the color scale and the positioning of the worst, I think, is very easy to understand.
Yeah, but I think the percentage part could do a lot of revamping. I was talking with Ian Livingston last night on Twitter, and he was talking about that, how they really need to revamp their percentage probability if they want the public to, you know, see those percentages and use them. Because right now it's only really useful to meteorologist.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's geared for the DIFAX era where you're sending a fax to the local forecasters about what's going to happen. I mean, it's just not going to work in this day and age, especially when they're trying to communicate directly
with
people. I mean, that's the topic that comes up all the time now with all these social media accounts. The National Weather Service is communicating directly with the end users, and some of the stuff is hard to understand.
Right. It absolutely is.
But I mean, I love the SPC outlooks from the positioning and the color standpoint, but it's the, you know, the actual details that matter that are hard to understand. So yes, I think simple indices or a simple index necessary, but you know, there's definitely negative impacts when everyone has their own.
Yeah. Well, we'll have more severe weather this year. Obviously we're in the beginnings of severe weather season. So we'll definitely hit this topic some more, and hopefully we can bring someone on to talk about this a little more in depth. Maybe even someone from the SPC. That would be really nice. But we're going to move on today to our main topic. Although I guess our main topic tonight is going to get just as much time as our tweets this week. Cause you know, it was a big thing this week in the weather community was a severe event. So, tonight we have Jamie Dyer. He's a meteorologist. He's a professor in geosciences at Mississippi State, and he does research using drones to collect atmospheric data. And I talked to him earlier this week about what he does and how he sees drones impacting the weather community. And let's listen in to that right now.
And we'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Jamie Dyer. He's a professor in the Department of Geosciences at Mississippi State University. Jamie, welcome to the show.
All right, thanks for having me.
So off the bat, I wanted to give our viewers an idea of what your research interest is and some of the problems that you're digging into at Mississippi State.
My initial research is actually in hydrometeorology and surface atmosphere interactions, where I'm trying to find influences of surface features like vegetation, soils, and soil wetness on boundary layer processes. And lately, my research has been moving more into observations, where I'm starting to incorporate unmanned aerial systems, UASs, and trying to get that lower atmospheric profile, trying to get those observations in.
Gotcha. So you're actually putting different sensors on the, I guess, can we call them drones? Is that an accurate?
Yeah, I think the common term is drones, but the technical term, you know, to make everybody happy is unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs.
Gotcha.
And then when you put a sensor on it, it becomes a system, and that's a UAS.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
So what kind of data are you trying to get, like temperature, moisture, pressure?
Yeah, so our initial efforts are for thermodynamic profiles. So we're getting pressure, temperature, and moisture, usually relative humidity. Ideally, we could get wind speed and wind direction, but those aren't directly measured by the drones. So usually you have to back calculate that from the autopilot.
Gotcha.
And we're not getting very good estimates from that, so we're just focusing on temperature, pressure, and moisture.
So what have you guys found by getting this kind of finer scale resolution data? Is there any...
So we're kind of in the early stages of doing this, and a lot of my research has dealt with basically the urban heat island effect, but over agricultural areas. So where you have a boundary between forested areas and then crops, you basically get like a wall of heat if you go over the crops. And I've done numerical weather prediction with that and tried to use existing soundings and stuff, but you can't verify the models because you don't have really high resolution data.
Gotcha.
And I've also done similar research on the coast for sea breeze formation, things like that. So the drones allow us to fly in a very specific area at any time of the day we want to get very high spatial resolution data, usually over a few square kilometers. But we use that to verify the model. We use that to try to outline or define those thermodynamic boundaries. And then that helps us find that interaction between the surface and the atmosphere.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. I'm assuming there's a lot of technical aspects you have to focus on. Who do you have to work with to, I guess, first approve the drones, and then when you're in the air, who do you have to work with to make sure you're not in someone's area, or if you're in a fine area? What's that process like?
Right. That is an excellent question, and I can I can provide a good answer on that because I am just now submitting a proposal to the Vortex SE project.
Wow.
Where we're proposing to fly UAVs into the rear flank downdraft of supercell thunderstorms.
Oh my gosh, that is awesome.
Yeah. So we're building off of a research done in the Vortex 2 experiment from Colorado, where that team flew UASs into the updraft region, the rotation, and the RFD, kind of as a proof of concept to see if it was possible. Mm-hmm. And we want to take that a step further, where we want to take those measurements, and we're trying to figure out the area of baroclinicity behind the storm, basically the cold pool,
mm-hmm.
to see if that temperature gradient behind the storm in the lower boundary layer can be used to predict tornado genesis. So we're trying to see where that rotation comes from and how it's being pulled up into the storm. And to answer your question, we have to get permission, a lot of permission, to do this, mainly from the FAA and also from NOAA through their Office of Marine and Aviation, Office of Marine and Aviation Organization or something like that. But you have to go through NOAA to show that you are doing UAS research for scientific reasons. And then you have to get FAA approval to get what's called a Certificate of Authorization, a COA, to fly to a certain level. And since we're flying basically over North Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, we had to have a COA in place so that we could fly whenever, wherever, up to 400 feet, because we don't know where the storms are going to exist.
Right.
And we were a little bit worried that we wouldn't get the permission, but today, actually, we got the permission for a 400-foot COA over the entire U.S.
Wow. How hard is it to get that kind of permission?
It's not easy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of paperwork you have to file, but the advantage with Mississippi State is we are a like a certified expert in unmanned aerial systems.
Mm.
So Mississippi State does a lot of research with drones over agricultural areas. So we do precision ag, and also in coastal areas where we do hydrologic assessment. We're taking photographs of water bodies to get inundation and water quality, things like that. So our advantage is that we have a pre-existing relationship with the FAA and with NOAA.
Gotcha.
So when I put in for this permission to fly in severe weather environments, we had to kind of change our approach, but we were granted that COA, which was a really nice thing to see.
So it's for other research groups, it might be harder just because of the position that Mississippi State is in at the moment.
Yeah, so for someone else, it would be a lot more difficult. You'd have to show proof of concept. You'd have to show that you understand what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And you also have to show that you have trained and certified pilots that can fly the UAVs and can contact air traffic control, you know, do all the paperwork, fill out all the logs that need to be filled out. So it would be more difficult for other universities or other agencies, but I think the big advantage there is they could work with somebody like Mississippi State to collaborate.
Yeah.
And then that would give them the experience, and then they could move on with further projects by themselves.
Gotcha. So you mentioned you have to have pilots. How does that work when you're tracking a storm? Do you have to set up shop for like a minute or two to launch the drone, or what's that process like?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. We're not really sure because we are basing all of our stuff off the Vortex 2 experiment where it was out in the plains in Colorado, eastern Colorado, where it's flat, you don't have a lot of vegetation, so you have really good line of sight, you have LP supercells, whereas we're going to be in Alabama and Mississippi, where it's the exact opposite. We've got terrain, really tall trees, and who knows what kind of weather conditions, but we're expecting high precipitation supercells. We're hoping for anyway.
Yeah.
And our COA, our permission, is only for line of sight. So what we're going to have to do is basically pull up just south of the rotation in the supercell and then have the drone ready, jump out, launch it, either hand-launched or through a bungee cord-type launch system, and then fly it. The pilot will be sitting in the car or standing next to it, flying the drone, visual contact at all times, manual flight operation. And then if the storm is moving too fast and we can't keep up, we'll have to hop in the car and basically chase the storm.
Wow.
To make sure that the pilot is always in contact with the drone.
Wow. That's incredible. That's got to be one skilled pilot to do that.
Yeah, and these pilots are pretty good. We have two trained pilots, and they're fully certified, and they fly everything from the fixed-wing drones like we're proposing to the quadcopters to the all kinds of stuff. And
go ahead.
It's pretty – I was going to say it's impressive how they do it because normally we want to put it on autopilot.
Yeah.
But at least for this Vortex SV experiment, they can't do that.
Yeah.
So their visual acuity is pretty amazing because they're flying that thing. They know how far away it is. And they're pretty high-tech drones, so they're not just kind of guessing which direction it's flying. They've got an iPad or some sort of tablet that shows altitude, direction, speed, things like that.
Gotcha. So this is the first time it's been done outside of the plains, and otherwise it's the second time in a research setting that this has been done?
For direct insertion into a supercell, I think so. There have been a lot of UAV work for storm damage assessment, path assessment, boundary layer assessment, but I don't know of anything else besides the Vortex 2 team that is trying to go in supercells.
Yeah, well, so it's certainly groundbreaking, and it seems like a really great way to get some of that finer scale data to really nail down tornado genesis. I'm blown away right now. I did not realize that was one of your big projects that you had going on. So that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. I am tentatively optimistic.
Yeah.
That we'll get this funding, and it's a really great project. And then, of course, since it's funded by NOAA, the next step is to work with the NOAA UAS office to figure out how we could make this operational, how we can make drones part of the standard observational setup that they have.
So that's a perfect segue into what I wanted to talk to you about next is doing exactly that, because it was a few years ago, I had this pipe dream when drones were becoming the the next big thing. And I was like, you know, it'd be great if we could have drones as our weather balloons. And I was talking with a friend, and they were like, that's crazy. And then I went to your talk at AMS, and you mentioned that, and I was like, oh my gosh, it's a thing that can actually happen, and it sounds awesome. Do you see that as actually happening, I don't know, in the next 5 to 10 years, or is it longer than that?
Well, again, tentatively optimistic.
Yeah.
I would think, yes, within 5 to 10 years, drones, small UAVs, are going to be a standard observational platform for the Weather Service and for NOAA. I mean, it's just, it makes too much sense to use UAVs to do boundary layer or even lower free atmospheric soundings and observations.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the big mistakes is people say that drones could replace sondes, replace basically balloons.
Yeah.
But I don't think you're ever going to be able to send drones up to 40, 50, 60,000 feet
right.
continuously on a repeating basis, because there's just going to be too much lag time in the flight space and the national airspace. But one thing we really lack in meteorology is boundary layer observation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these drones could be very useful where they're just automatically sent up. They only go up a couple hundred feet, maybe a few thousand feet, and they fly a spatial back and forth pattern. And then they automatically come back to their little charging station and wait for the next 12 hours or something. I definitely think UAVs are going to play a role there.
Gotcha.
Or at least I hope they do anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Especially big severe weather outbreaks, I can see them being super useful to sample some of that finer scale, I guess, on a time scale data. Because they send up special sondes usually at during a big outbreak, but I don't know if you need how high you need to go at that point. So that was music to my ears when you said that. 5 to 10 years, they're at least going to play a role. I noticed. Go ahead.
So I was going to say, I think they'll definitely play a role. The big question now is, what role will they play?
Yeah.
I think that's where a lot of the current research, like I'm proposing, is going to be important, is seeing what they can do and how they can best be utilized. So it's not a question of if we can use them, it's how can we use them.
Gotcha. So we've basically talked about using UAVs to collect data and number data, the quantitative data. Have you used drones at all to take imagery of the surface or of atmospheric processes?
Yeah, so that's actually the main application right now at Mississippi State, at least, is to use the UAVs as a platform to hold cameras and different sensors like that to look at the surface.
Gotcha.
So a lot of my initial research over the past few years, I have actually had to take instrumentation, weather instruments,
mm-hmm.
and modify them so that I could just quickly put them on the UAVs, because the UAV's main task is surface photography.
Gotcha.
So I'm just kind of piggybacking. And that's not to say that, you know, what I'm finding isn't important or that it's not wanted.
Yeah.
It's just that these drones can only weigh so much, and there's only so much cargo area for them or on them.
Mm-hmm.
So we're basically trying to perform multiple experiments with each flight.
Wow.
So a lot of the stuff I'm doing over agricultural areas along the coast, the main mission is actually surface photography, but then the remote sensors, they actually need atmospheric information to help with the correction of the photographs.
Gotcha.
So I give them my information, especially pressure and temperature, so that they can correct the photographs to get the best resolution, the best clarity. And then I have the data to do my own research for, you know, boundary layer processes, especially mesoscale fronts and boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So are they looking at the vegetation and how it's changed, or what are they looking at in the photograph?
Yeah, so eventually they're looking for change detection, but right now they're just looking for vegetation type, cover, water quality is a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, especially for the hydrologist, we're looking for land water masks. So what what is land, what is water?
Yeah.
And then when you have a flood moving downstream, you can fly the drones and get another picture of land water to see what area is inundated. And then that kind of takes the place of river gauges and the areas that aren't gauged, that aren't monitored.
Gotcha. Wow, that's cool. Is that a more common application for UAVs right now?
I think so. That's what I've been seeing a lot more of. And as far as the meteorological implications of that is storm path assessment, damage assessment. Because you can quickly get a UAV in the air and take pictures wherever you need. And it's cheap, it's quick. You get a lot of coverage in a short amount of time. So that's the big advantage of them.
Gotcha. That's great. And before this conversation, I was less optimistic about the application of drones and meteorology. But your research has really lit a fire. So hopefully, everything goes well and we see more and more UAVs in our science. I have one last question. I ask this to everyone that comes onto the show, and it's what kind of advice would you give to a young and up-and-coming meteorologist, and what has been the most important skill that you've used throughout your career?
I would say the most important skill that I've had is not putting myself in a specific niche. Mm-hmm. So my background, I went from physics to hydrology to meteorology, so I was always in a different discipline, always trying something new. So I never really became a real expert in any one thing. So my skill is that I can kind of mold my expertise to fit different projects. So I became a really good collaborator. And that was one of the most useful skills. And I really built on that by working with a bunch of different teams and a bunch of different projects and, never saying no. When someone came along and said, do you want to be involved with this? I would say, sure.
Yeah.
I may not be an expert, but I want to learn something. So always keep an open mind, be willing to keep learning, even as a professor. I mean, every day you're finding something new from other professors and from students. So the biggest advice, keep an open mind, be willing to work on different projects, new projects, and just be flexible in what you do, what you're capable of.
Gotcha. I love it. Thanks so much for joining us. And we hope to have you on again.
All right. I appreciate it. Anytime.
And that wraps up our interview with Dr. Jamie Dyer from Mississippi. Fascinating to be using drones. I am a big fan of drones. They've really come onto the scene here in the last couple of years, especially with major news events and natural disasters. And now it seems like they're finally making their way into, higher education and research.
Yeah, could you imagine? The two things that pop out here for me is drones actually not replacing the weather balloon, but just upping the spatial and temporal frequency of collecting that lower atmosphere data, and then driving a car chasing a tornado while manning a drone that's supposed to be flying near the tornado. That blows my mind. Like, that seems like fantasy to me and seems impossible to do, but apparently that's what they're going to do, and they have good enough pilots to do that.
Now, do you have any idea what type of drone he was talking about? Because I heard him say fixed wing.
Yeah.
A lot of times when I think of a drone, I think of the smaller ones with the propellers, but is the drone he was talking about larger?
Yeah, I believe, I don't know the terminology, but I believe they're basically just small planes. They're not actually they don't have the horizontal propellers. They're bigger drones.
But probably not as big as the ones the military uses.
No, probably somewhere in between. But the fixed wing drones are less finicky. And I can't imagine trying to get a smaller drone with, horizontal propellers near a turbulent storm like that.
I can't imagine getting any kind of drone next to
a storm like
that with all that wind. I mean, I wonder what the chance is that it gets knocked down.
Probably pretty high. I'm excited. It hasn't gotten completely funded yet, but he has the okay to do it. He just needs the funding to do it. So it's going to be interesting, and hopefully it works out, because I think his research can really lead the way for other universities and other organizations to do more research with drones, and something that I think we should capitalize on as a community. So yeah, thanks again, Dr. Jamie Dyer, for joining us, and hopefully we can have him on sometime soon, maybe even when he's doing the research and then after he's doing the research. But that's going to do it for us tonight. And you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Follow us at the WX Junkies. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, and iTunes, and also Stitcher. And if you're on iTunes, give us a rating or a review, whether it's good or bad. We just want to hear from you. And Tyler, what can we expect next week?
Yes, we have major news. The legendary Bob Ryan will join the show live next Thursday at 8 o'clock. That is the Bob Ryan from the Washington, D.C. area. He served as the chief meteorologist at NBC-owned WRC from 1980 to 2010, and then he worked at ABC affiliate WJLA from 2010 to 2013. So a Washington, D.C. area legend in broadcast meteorology. We are very excited to have him on the Weather Junkies next week, and we will certainly be promoting the show as we lead up to it, because we are very excited to have Bob Ryan on, and we certainly hope that you are too. For this week, though, for Jamie Dyer, Dakota, and myself, thank you for tuning in, and we hope to see you right back here next week.